Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform with one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite.
Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/stereo. netsuite.com/stereo.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Welcome, everyone, back to our series on key battles in World War I. In the previous episode, we looked at the Battle of Gallipoli. The Allies believed that they could go up the Strait of Dardanelles, quickly knock the Ottoman Empire out of World War I, reach Constantinople, give it to Russia so that it could become a warm water port for them, have easy access to the Black Sea, and be able to attack the Central Powers on two sides. But they weren't able to do that due to many factors, not one of least was a dashing colonel named Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, which we... I mentioned him all over the place last episode, so James has that noise whenever I do it. That could be a drinking game for this series like we had for previous ones, but...
Maybe just for that one episode.
Yeah, okay, listeners, if you have a night where you're with your friends and you really want to booze it up, then okay, there you go. You have that going on. So that was the major battle of 1915. Now, in previous episodes, James was describing all the ways that the war just metastasizes in 1914. Germany explodes out in through Belgium, attacks France, attacks Russia. But then both sides dig their trenches, and they're mostly locked in place. It almost seemed like the war, I wouldn't say stops, but it marks time. So... we don't have a major battle to cover here, but 1915 is still important to cover. So we're going to be jumping around from place to place in the war and give you an idea of what is going on in this year, even though there might not be a major battle outside of Gallipoli to attach to it. So start us off, James. What's happening on the Western Front?
Okay, so as Scott implied or stated, we're not going to have another major battle, a key battle, in 1915. The Gallipoli's it. But that doesn't mean nothing happened. Plenty of things happened. On the Western Front, in the winter of 1914-1915, Joffre wanted to push the Germans back and help prevent them from sending more troops to the east. So he launched a series of offenses in late 1914 and early 1915. And I'm just going to briefly mention these. We're not going to go into any detail about them for the sake of time, but you had the First Battle of Artois, which was from December 17, 1914 to January 13, 1915. Then you had the, concurrent with that, in a different location, you had the First Champagne Offensive, and this was in the region of Champagne. Okay, it's not because the soldiers were drinking champagne.
They wish.
Oh, here, let me toast my German opponent. This was from December 20, 1914 to March 17, 1915. On this one, there were 93,000 French casualties and 46,000 Germans. even though these are what most historians would not consider the major, the huge epic battles of the war, nevertheless, they were very bloody. One interesting thing on the Western Front, and this is just a really cool story, it's called the Christmas Truce. Probably most of our listeners have already heard of this. I think we mentioned it before, didn't we, Scott? But we'll mention it again.
Never hurts.
Because I remember mentioning Paul McCartney's video on his song Pipes of Peace. But on Christmas Day 1914, the two sides stopped firing at each other, and a German soldier pops out of the trenches and doesn't get shot. That's a rare thing. And the French soldier pops out and so on. And then more and more come out and they start exchanging greetings and showing each other pictures of their sweethearts. And they're singing Christmas carols, and there's even a soccer game. So a demonstration of Christmas spirit, if you will, and camaraderie. Just for one day, they were human beings, not people that were trying to kill each other, but that didn't last much longer. Now, the officers hated that, and the officers said, there will be no more of these truces, and there weren't. There'll be an Easter truce on the Eastern Front. I forget exactly what year that is, but other than this, the officers pretty much tell them, all right, your job is to kill, to shoot and kill as many people as you can on that other side, so no more of these truces.
We'll see this when we get to the Easter truce, but so here, this is something James and I, because we're history nerds, would question, but okay, Russians on one side, Germans on the other, wouldn't their Easters be different due to Orthodox on one side and then Catholic / Protestant on the other?
Yeah, they are sometimes, but other times they're not. I remember here fairly recently, maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago, we actually had 2 years in a row where they were the same. It's because of the different calendars that are used in the two churches.
It's that Julian calendar.
Yeah, the Julian calendar is used by the Orthodox churches, at least for Easter, but sometimes they're the same day, or they could be 5 weeks apart. Orthodox is always later. One of the great things about being Orthodox is you can get Easter candy on sale after the after Catholic and Protestant Easter is over. You can get your Easter candy half price. But anyway, in March of 1915, Germans began experimenting with flamethrowers and also armored shields, and the French began using hand grenades. So we're starting to see, I don't want anybody to think of this war as just total static, no progress, no nothing. There wasn't a lot of movement, but there was a lot of technological innovation, and we'll be seeing that over the course of the war. On March 10th, the British First Army, which was led by Sir Douglas Haig, much more on him later, he attacked the Germans at Neuve-Chapelle. I forgot to talk to my French friend this week, so I apologize if I butcher these French names, people. And Haig had a policy called bite and hold, and that meant quickly taking a piece of the enemy's line and forcing them to counterattack it, making the enemy suffer many casualties. And that, like everything on the Western Front, had limited success. Then going into the spring, on April 17th, the British launched an attack at a place called Hill 60, and they used mines to undermine the German position. So that's another kind of a new thing, although mines are as old as warfare itself, but the explosives now are much more powerful. We're going to see later in the war, there's going to be a huge battle in which explosives and mines play a major, major part. April 22nd, the Germans began the Second Battle of Ypres, and they used 600 cylinders, which is 168 tons of chlorine gas. This is the first time gas is used with major consequences. We've seen it used before, but the British just were devastated by these gas attacks. They used makeshift respirators. Sometimes if they didn't have a gas mask, officers would shout to the men, pee on your handkerchief, pee on your handkerchief. They would actually take a cloth, a handkerchief or some other cloth, maybe a towel if they had one, and they would urinate on it. And somehow the urine on the cloth, the chemicals in the urine helped keep the chlorine gas away. That's really gross and really weird, but it beats the heck out of choking to death because of chlorine gas.
Yeah, or blindness or anything else.
You're right. The Allies held the town. The battle lasted just over a month. On May 8th, the British and French launched a combined offensive. This is the first time that they jointly attacked something. This is the second Battle of Artois. We're going to see throughout this war, there's going to be a lot of battles on the same place. You'll have the first battle, second battle, third battle. There's even a second Battle of the Marne, which is going to happen in 1918. But this second Battle of Artois lasted 7 weeks. The Allies lost 100,000 casualties, while the Germans lost 75,000. Excuse me. Battle after battle after battle. We're calling them minor battles, but they're losing tens of thousands of people every single time. It's just a bloodbath. In late September, this is again 1915, the British and French launched offenses at Loos, Artois. This is the third Battle of Artois now, and Champagne, the second battle. And the British used poison gas for the first time in these battles. The British and French initially took their objectives, but a stubborn German defense caused massive Allied casualties. The Germans used a new type of gas, or at least new to the war, phosgene gas, which is even worse than chlorine. And these battles ended the first week of November. Neither side gained anything, which is pretty much the story of the Western Front in general. By the end of 1915, the British government was fed up with the British Army's lack of progress, and so they fired the overall commander, Sir John French, and they replaced him with Sir Douglas Haig. So Haig, who had been one of French's subordinates, is now the head honcho. French gets to go home. He's out of the war. And now we're going to have Haig as the commander. We'll have much to say about Haig in the future. But that's what I have for the Western Front. That takes us all the way to the end of 1915. Scott, any thoughts?
Well, I guess it's more of an observation, and I like to get your take on it since you've delved into this much more deeply, is that it seems that in 1915, the technology is advancing, where you're seeing the use of armor, you're seeing gas, which later on becomes a war crime. So for all of World War II's horrors, that's not part of it, at least not against soldiers, against civilians, which I guess is even more horrible. But it seems like the technology is catching up, but tactics still really haven't evolved. Later on in the war, when you do see breakouts, you're seeing evolution in tactics, combined arms assaults of using tanks in coordination with artillery strikes and troops rushing out and whatever help and aid planes can provide, although that's very minimal at this point. They're better for reconnaissance. Later on, the tactics do catch up. But they're not quite there yet. Would you think that's an accurate observation, or would you want to add to anything to that?
No, I think that's an excellent way of stating it. Yeah, they're almost where they need to be by the end of the war. And then, of course, Germany gives up. So it's going to take them by the time you get to 1939, the technology is so much more advanced. You're going to have a totally different kind of war in World War II than you have in World War I.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what's happening on the Eastern Front?
All right, Eastern Front, on January 31st, 1915, there's a battle called the Battle of Bolimov, and this is actually the very first time poison gas is used. The Germans unleashed this on the Russians, but it barely even worked. The weather was so cold. Austria launched three offensives against Russian forces in the Carpathian Mountains, which formed the border at that time between Austria-Hungary and Russia. All three of them failed miserably. As many as 100,000 Austrian soldiers froze to death. That's just awful. And there's stories of wolves that were eating people alive, even wounded. So it's just really, really a typically incompetent Austrian operation. The Austrian army is not really much of an army. It's nowhere near on the level of the German army. In fact, the German leaders, I can't remember who originally said this, but they said being allied with Austria is like being shackled to a corpse. It's a famous quote. And Germany is constantly having to come in and help them and bail them out. Now, speaking of bad things happening to Austria, here's another one. The fortress of Przemysl, which we talked about last time, the Russians had been laying siege to it. It fell to the Russians on March 23rd. And as a result, 126,000 prisoners were taken. Austrian prisoners were taken by the Russians, and over 700 big guns.
How does Austria have any soldiers left at this point?
Well, they're not going to have many. That's the thing is, They do. I mean, all of these, we have to remember that all of these nations had called up a large percentage of their military aged men. And so they have armies that number in the millions. But yeah, Austria, I don't know that they ever actually really recover from this. I mean, they're still around, but, and they're going to last well in 1918, but they're seriously damaged. They're going to be like fighting with one hand chopped off or something now. That's a weird analogy, I guess,
but an accurate one.
Actually, it makes a lot of sense in this war.
Yeah, it does.
On May 1st, the Germans did come and help the Austrians, and a combined German-Austrian army launched an offensive against the Russians at Gorlice and Tarnow. The Russians had to retreat. They lost all the land that they had gained since the start of the war. This is going to be a seesaw battle in the east. It's very, there's a lot of movement. It's very fluid, unlike the west. 30,000 Russian prisoners were taken, and Austrian forces recaptured Przemysl on June 3rd and Lwów on June 22nd. So the Russians didn't get to hold on to that fortress for very long, not even 3 months. Now, further north, up near the Baltic Sea, Russians began to retreat from Warsaw and Riga, which is in modern-day Latvia. In Poland, Russian forces adopted a scorched earth policy. And here we're going to see very cruel treatment of the Poles by the Russians. The Russians forced the Poles and other residents of Poland and Western Russia to burn their crops, abandon their homes, you know, kill their animals. They barely even let them gather up enough stuff even to live on, you know, blankets and carts and stuff. And they said, get out of here. And so millions of refugees are created.
Hey, everyone. Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform with one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite.
Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/stereo. netsuite.com/stereo.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Warsaw fell to the German army on August 5th, 1915, and soon after, several other key Russian cities fell as well to the Germans. So the Germans are just rolling through there. They take Ivangorod, Kovno, Novogiorgiev, Brest-Litovsk, Bialystok, and the Grodno Fortress. Hope I said those right. I'm much better with Slavic languages, believe it or not, than I am with French, But by the end of August 1915, the Germans and Austrians had taken, get this, Scott, this is just mind-boggling. Listener, try not to fall out of your chair, especially if you're driving. But the Germans and Austrians captured 1.5 million Russian prisoners. So Russia had been dealing out some hurt to the Austrians, but now they're going to take some. Soon after, the Austrians and Germans lined up to form a single line. So it's not looking good for Russia. things are looking really bad. Russia had got off to a fairly decent start, at least in the southern part of the Eastern Front, but now they're just being pushed back relentlessly. And as a result, on September 15th, Tsar Nicholas decided to remove the Grand Duke Nikolai from the command. He, as I mentioned last episode, he was the overall supreme commander of the armed forces. And guess who he replaced him with? I wonder if anybody of our listeners know.
Anyone?
Answer is he replaced him with himself. Tsar Nicholas took personal command of the army, and all of his subordinates were going, no.
This will be like when Michael Jordan was part owner of the Washington Wizards and decided, I'm going to play personally and come out of retirement as a 40-year-old man. So,
yeah, even that didn't work out too well for Michael. But at least Michael was good back in the day. Tsar Nicholas was just not a very talented man in general. He just wasn't real great at anything, and certainly not being a commander of an army. So this is a really bad decision. Not only does he put someone who's not qualified for the job, that is himself, in charge of the army, but that takes him away from the capital. So he's not in St. Petersburg, or Petrograd, as they renamed it. And that means he's not there to keep an eye on maybe revolutionary things that are starting to happen.
Yeah, I would be thinking about a change in government if I were there, that, you know, Tsar Nicholas is not up to, I wonder if there was anyone else thinking that at the time. So,
yeah,
I don't know.
There's just a few thousand, or if not tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, but more on that later. On September 18th, the Germans keep rolling. They take Vilna, or Vilnius, in modern day Lithuania. They drove its Russian defenders completely out of Poland and Galicia. Galicia, or Galicia, is the part of Russia that's right by Austria-Hungary. Actually, I think it's in Austria-Hungary at this time, now that I think about it. I remember the game I used to play, Diplomacy. It was in Austria-Hungary. I remember that was a space you didn't want Russia in if you were Austria. But now they're out. Russia, in all these advances, or retreats actually on their part, they had lost 300 miles of territory. But now the weather takes over. The ground became muddy. The Russians improved their defenses. It's getting cold. And this stops the German advance.
Tale as old as time, everyone.
Yes, exactly. And General Winter starts to take command here. After Christmas, the Russian army launched major offenses in Bessarabia. That's over near Romania. Eastern Galicia. And they attacked in other places, including the Pripyat marches. But none of these succeeded. So let's sum it up. By the end of 1915, Russia had suffered 3.4 million casualties. 3.4 million. That's just mind-boggling. That's just Russia. And there were 2 million Russians displaced by the war. So I've seen in one book, they said 1915 was the year of the Central Powers. The Central Powers are kicking butt, especially in the East. It's not looking good for Russia. So that's kind of sums up what's going on in the Eastern Front. If we had to sum it up in one word or two words, it's like Russia retreats. What do you think, Scott?
Yeah, that is a very large loss. And the momentum of the war does seem to be going toward the Central Powers. We'll fill in the details a lot more in the next several episodes when the United States finally gets involved. And that does heavily push the momentum. But there are a lot of interesting what-ifs here. I think there's not a consensus, but many think that World War II could have never conceivably been won by the Axis powers because they simply were fighting on too many fronts. And there's an argument over how long it would have taken for ultimate victory, to be sure, but they simply did not have the fundamentals in place to be able to win. However, World War I is a whole different situation where you have, this is what Dan Carlin argued, that Germany in World War I had all the advantages and none of the disadvantages, where you have excellent general staff, but you don't have an incompetent Führer at the top that is wrecking things, and you have a more robust portfolio of allies too. So the Ottomans fighting on the Eastern Front and other things going on. So
yeah, it's funny that you said that Hitler was kind of the Tsar Nicholas of World War II in a way. You think about it, he was a not that great of a military commander who thought he was really something special. But anyway, we digress. So let's move on to the Balkans now. We saw previously, and I've mentioned this a couple times now, that the Austrians had tried to go in and you know, put some hurt on Serbia, and the Serbians just slapped them right back into Austria. But things are going to start changing in 1915. In March, a typhus epidemic broke out in Serbia, killing many Serbs as well as many Austrians. The outbreak prevented any attacks on Serbia for a while, but the Austrians are not going to give up so easily. Now, on April 1st, a force of Bulgarian Turks attacked Valandovo in Macedonia. Now, Macedonia, there's a lot of controversy about that country today, but when I say Macedonia, I'm speaking about the Slavic area that is south of Serbia, north of Greece. It's not Greek Macedonia. It's I think today they call it the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, right? Or more northern, is it northern Macedonia? I can't remember how that panned out. But anyway, at this time, it's part of Serbia. Serb forces repelled the invasion, so that didn't work. But then things change dramatically. On September 6, 1915, Bulgaria, that is Serbia's neighbor to the east, and they have a major chip on their shoulder against the Serbs and have for hundreds of years. Serbs and Bulgarians had fought over this territory in this area many times. Bulgaria joins the Central Powers. So very soon after that, along with Austria, Hungary, and Germany, they invaded Serbia. This began on October 6th. This time, Serbia is not going to be able to fight off the opponents. They've got Austrians and Germans coming down from the north, but they've also got Bulgarians coming from the east. So they're going to get enveloped, basically. And sure enough, Belgrade, the capital of Serbia, falls on October 9th. Bulgaria, by the way, fun fact here, they sent 25% of their entire population to war.
Wow.
Okay, that's counting everybody, men, women, children, 25% went to war. They must have had pretty much every man that could even hold a gun going into there. So, yeah, they were serious. They wanted to settle a score with the Serbs. They had just been defeated by the Serbs in the Second Balkan War just a few years before this. On November 5th, the city of Niš fell. This is in southern Serbia, major city there. And this gave the Central Powers a direct rail link from Berlin to Constantinople. At the end of the month, the Serbian army was defeated and forced to retreat. And then you had the massive retreat, the trek to the sea. And this is a major thing. You talked about how Gallipoli is a major iconic event in Turkish history. Well, this retreat and this grueling march that the Serbs are going to do is still very much remembered among the Serbs today. It's kind of like their Valley Forge, if you will. In December, the remains of the Serbian army, along with several hundred thousand civilians who realized they better get out of Serbia, they don't want to be there, because the Austrians had been committing a lot of atrocities. We mentioned that in an earlier episode. The Austrians would just take Serbs out in the, out in the field and just shoot them and do even worse things sometimes. So the civilians realized they needed to get out of there too. Without the protection of the Serbian army, they were going to be in big trouble. So the army and the civilians fled through the freezing mountains of Montenegro, which at this time was an independent country, but very similar to Serbia ethnically and linguistically. So these poor Serbs are trekking through Montenegro, freezing mountains. Then they had to go through Albania. All this time, Albanian tribesmen are shooting at them and picking them off and trying to cause as much trouble as they can. And out of 700,000 people that started on this march, 200,000 died along the way. That's just unbelievable. That's more than 25%. But they finally did reach the coast. This is the Adriatic Sea between the Balkans and Italy. And Allied naval forces evacuated them from the Albanian coast to Corfu, which is a Greek island. So they will reform and regather and build their strength back up, and they'll be able to fight another day. French and British forces tried to help the Serbian army, but as we saw, they had landed in Salonika, Greece, but they were unable to go very far north, and this was largely due to the Bulgarian army. They established the base at Salonika over the objections of the Greek government, which was neutral, but the Allies said, we don't care. We need the space. And in January 2016, that's a mistake in my – it's not 2016, 1916 – in January 1916, the Austrian army invaded Montenegro.
That would be a weird headline in 2016 that the Austrian army invades Montenegro.
Yeah, the Austrian army today is pretty small. But anyway, so Austria invades Montenegro. The government surrenders, but the army fled into Albania. So the Austrians said, well, let's just go there too. So they also invaded Albania. So again, and in the Balkans, as well as on the Eastern Front and the Western Front, nothing but defeat and disaster for the Allied powers. Serbia, of course, was one of the Allied powers as well. Not really a power, but they were part of the alliance. Not looking good for the Allies, right, Scott?
Very poor, yes. It's just getting demolished on every side.
Yeah, here's an area where we're going to move to this further south now. We're going to look at what's going on in 1915 in Egypt, Mesopotamia, as well as Italy. Things are going to be quite a bit better for the Allies there. So in February of 1915, the Ottoman forces attacked British forces in Egypt. They tried to take the Suez Canal, and they were soundly defeated. This was just an absolute fiasco. And then this is not really a battle or anything like that, but in 1915, Turkey began the forced deportation of the Armenians within Turkey or the Ottoman Empire. And Scott's going to elaborate on that a little bit.
Yes. So this leads to what is known as the Armenian Genocide, which is, we've been talking about these moments in nation's history that are cornerstone to their identity. And Armenians, if you talk to somebody from Armenia or someone who is of Armenian background in the United States or elsewhere, this is a very big thing in their lives and identity. Basically, what's happening is the Ottoman Empire had military rivalry with Russia for centuries. They had fought in eastern Anatolia. Borders had moved back and forth. Russia captured a certain part of eastern Anatolia in 1870. Then Turkey at one point was able to retake it. And there were a number of Armenians who wanted to have their own nation. And they were looking at what other groups in the Balkans who had also used to be under Ottoman control had done. So what Bulgaria had done, for example, in the 1870s was to trigger a rebellion. The Ottoman army comes in. Then Russia swoops in, offers its support, defeats the Ottomans, and that leads to the creation of an independent Bulgaria. Many Armenians, or some wanted that as well. There was a political movement. The Ottomans were skittish that a group of people on its eastern borders, there were millions of ethnic Armenians in eastern Anatolia. Many of them were simple Ottoman subjects who didn't really want to get involved in any political plot. They just wanted to live their lives and not die. The Ottomans were skittish because they thought that they could be potential allies to the Russians. What that led to was a forced march, a forced deportation away from Russian lines to northern Syria. Well, these millions of people, they weren't provided any sort of protection, so Kurdish and other tribal groups could mercilessly attack them. They were given very few provisions, so it became a death march. It was Trail of Tears, but on a much, much, much larger scale, and there are mass graves that are still being found today. We have an abundance of press reports of foreign journalists who were there at the time. American foreign missionaries, many of which were in the Ottoman Empire at this time, also provide accounts. So there are enormous amount of counts. Some scholars argue whether or not it was a genocide. The only reason is that there's semantic quibbling on a genocide. They would define it as the planned ethnic cleansing and extermination of a group of people. Some wonder if it was just a forced deportation march that went horribly wrong. The consensus, and I would agree with this, is that it was a genocide because something like this leading to the death of millions of people, orders like that would have had to have come from high command, from the military triumvirate that controlled the Ottoman Empire at this time. So this is what happens to the Armenians. And later on, there's a famous quote to Adolf Hitler where he said, talking about plans for the extermination of the Jewish people, that few will forget about it. After all, who talks about the Armenians today? However, in Turkey, the Armenian genocide is categorically denied. Some people who have talked about it have been arrested. There's a law on the books in Turkey where it's a crime to insult Turkishness, whatever that means. It's very vague, so it can kind of mean anything. And the official narrative in Turkey is that in eastern Turkey, there were about 200,000 people who died, an equal number of Turks and Armenians. having to do with the general anarchy in Eastern Turkey. So it's not really anything that anyone planned. It was just due to the unfortunate nature of warfare and what James described, where people, civilians are marching through the mountains, many of them freeze to death. It's just the sad byproduct of war, but it's nothing that anyone planned. So Turkey is the only nation that really denies it. I believe the United States has formally recognized it. I can't remember, but there's about 30 or 40 nations have. I don't talk about it with my Turkish friends, so if any of them are listening, they're not going to be pleased with what I'm saying, just because it's such a thorny issue there. But that's all I have to say about that.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
What do you do when the world around you is falling apart? It's amazing to me how many people are breathing air. They're going about their business and doing the things you're supposed to do. But if you really ask them, they know that on the inside, they are spiritually and emotionally and relationally dead. If we're not careful, all of us can experience that death. When what we need to do, even as the world around us is falling apart, we need to learn how to march when it would be easier to stay where we are and die. Join me each week on the March or Die Show as we discuss that and so much more.
This episode is brought to you by Calitrin. Text the word unplug to 30605 and I'll send you a link to a wonderful product that can help you finally succeed in shedding that extra weight. I took Calitrin for several weeks last year and I felt great in several ways. I felt stronger, my workouts felt easier, I slept better, I was noticeably trimmer, there was no downside. Text the word unplug to 30605 right now to see this week's special offer on Calitrin. Calitrin contains collagen, the most abundant protein naturally occurring in the human body, which decreases as we age. Taking Calitrin promotes better sleep, more energy, less joint pain, and best of all, weight loss. Calitrin has an 86% success rate with their 90-day supply, and this week, take advantage of my special offer. Buy the 90-day supply and get an extra month free plus free shipping. Ordering is easy. Just text the word unplugged to 30605 and I'll send you a link to the special offer. Again, text unplugged to 30605.
All right. Now, in another part of the Ottoman Empire at this time controlled a good chunk of what is now Iraq today. And so the British decided to try yet another southern front, if you will. This is way southern front. We're talking near hundreds, if not 1,000 miles away from Europe. They took the city of Basra. I remember Basra, Scott, back in when you had the Iraq War, especially the first one, Desert Storm, where that was a major thing. It was taken by American forces, and there was like a rebellion there or something. But anyway, British troops took Basra, and then they advanced up the Tigris Valley toward Baghdad. But they became trapped at a fortress called Kut al-Amara, and the Turks put them under siege. Rather than the British besieging the Turks turned the tables on them. And so we'll see what happens there. In fact, let's go ahead and see right now. Next month, a rescue operation tried but failed to relieve them. Repeated attempts to rescue them would also fail, and the British force would eventually surrender in April 1916, leading to another death march in which I don't know how many hundreds of people died. Can't remember the exact numbers, but anyway, so to summarize, the British got off to a good start in the southern part of the Ottoman Empire, modern day Iraq, but then eventually stalled out and then met disaster. And then another major change to the war occurs on May 23rd of 1915. Italy joins the war on the side of the Allies. They attacked Austria-Hungary at the Isonzo River many times. Before the war's over, there's going to be no fewer than 12 battles. I talked about how on the Western Front you had the first, second, third, sometimes fourth battle of something, but they're going to keep going at it 12 times between
the 10th battle of Isonzo.
Yeah, you got to give the Italians credit. They don't give up easily. They fought multiple battles. They made very few gains. The fighting finally ended on December 10th due to winter weather. And in the summer, Italy raided the Adriatic coast in several places. So more fronts are opening up. We don't want you to think that you just have the Eastern Front and the Western Front in Europe. You have multiple fronts. You have fighting in Egypt. You have fighting in modern-day Iraq, you know, near Basra and Baghdad and places like that. You have the Italian front. You have the Balkan front. In fact, really, there's more than one Balkan front. You have and we're going to have Romania pretty soon. So it's the war is spreading, and it's getting messy, isn't it, Scott?
Oh, yeah. And also, I should mention that after Kutal Amara, that is the last of the Ottoman victories in World War I. That's it, ladies and gentlemen, for any Ottoman successes.
Yeah, they're going to be playing defense for the rest of the war. Yep. So it's not like 1915 is a total disaster for the Allies. They do have a few bright spots, like Italy coming in on their side. Italy originally was allied with Germany and Austria-Hungary. But when the war broke out, they just said, we changed our mind, Kaiser Bill. Sorry about that. They invoked a principle called sacred egoism, which means we have the right to do whatever we want and join whoever we want. Okay. Now, we're going to have an entire episode on the war at sea, and that's going to be a fun one. And then we're going to have another entire episode on the war in the air. But I just want to mention a few things that happened in 1914 and 1915 before we close out the year 1915. On December 14th, 1914, German ships bombarded the English cities of Scarborough, Whitley, and Hartlepool. And this killed several civilians. This is the first time that English civilians had been killed in a war since 1690. So it's a long time. So the Germans are taking the war to the English, taking it to their home. And this, of course, increased popular British hatred for the Germans. It also increased British hatred toward their own government. It's like, why aren't you protecting us? But we're going to see as well, there's going to be a lot of bombings on the part of the Hindenburg. It's not the Hindenburg, the Zeppelins. Hindenburg is much later. Hindenburg is a person right now. It's not a airship. But anyway, then in February of 1915, Germans began a policy of unrestricted submarine warfare. And this is going to be a major hot button issue throughout the war. Scott's going to tell us a little bit more about it.
Yeah. So, I mean, just a very short thing because we'll get into it later. But on February 4th, 1915, they announced that they're retaliating against what they call the illegal British blockade of German vessels. And they say, all the waters surrounding Great Britain and Ireland, including the whole of the English Channel, are hereby declared to be a war zone. From February 18th onwards, every enemy merchant vessel found within this war zone will be destroyed without it always being possible to avoid danger to the crews and passengers. Neutral ships will also be exposed to danger in the war zones, as in view of the misuse of neutral flags ordered on January 31st by the British government, and owing to unforeseen incidents to which naval warfare is liable, it is impossible to avoid attacks being made on neutral ships in mistake for those of the enemy. So I guess I won't give away too much here, but this will play a big part on what happens with America entering it and some other things too. So yeah, pretty important stuff.
Yeah. The British not only enacted a blockade on Germany, this was called a far blockade. They weren't putting their ships right by the German coast. They were somewhat removed, but it was just as effective. We're going to see that the effect of the blockade on Germany is going to really squeeze them over time. And eventually you're going to have Germans eating almost nothing but turnips, and it's going to cost several thousand German lives. At least that's estimated. The British also mined the North Sea. So the Germans kind of said, well, okay, so you don't want us using submarines, but then you're allowed to mine the North Sea. The mines in the North Sea actually sank more German ships than the submarines or the U-boats ever sank. So it's kind of an interesting thing, too. There's a lot of ironies in this war, just like every war. Then on May 7th, 1915, a German U-boat sinks the Lusitania. The Lusitania was a luxury liner, passenger liner, owned by the Cunard Company, kind of like the Titanic, except this one was actually a reserve British vessel. It had places where guns could be placed. It was carrying ammunition. So it wasn't just a completely innocent passenger liner as the British claimed it was. And in this sinking of the Lusitania, 1,200 people roughly died, including 120 Americans. And this is going to be one of the factors that starts many Americans wanting revenge and wanting to jump into the war, although it's going to take a while till they actually do. Another thing, a very important technological development that comes along in 1915 involves machine guns on airplanes. You know, initially in the war, it was kind of funny. It's funny to think of that when two planes of opposing sides would pass, they would just kind of wave to each other. Hey, how you doing? And then they realized, wait a minute, I need to kill that guy. This is a war. So they would start. They didn't have guns mounted on the planes. They would just take a pistol and fire it at the other guy, or maybe a rifle, although it's kind of hard to keep your hand on the steering wheel when you're using a two-handed gun. But anyway, then they put machine guns, but they had a tendency to fire upon their own propellers and damage their propellers. They tried putting – we'll talk more about this later. We'll say all this again. But for now, they would put steel plates on the propellers, but then the bullets tended to bounce back and do things, and, you know, hurt the pilot. So a Dutch inventor named Anthony Fokker – be very careful how you pronounce that, listener. Anyway, Anthony Fokker invented – what's called interrupter gear. And this synchronized the firing of the machine gun with the motion of the propeller. And so it would never fire a bullet when the propeller was right in front of the gun. So you would fire through the blank spaces in between the propeller blades. This was invented just for the Germans. And this led to German domination of the skies, which was called the Fokker Scourge. And let's see, we already talked about unrestricted submarine warfare. Eventually, it's going to be taken away and then brought back. But that's just a few things that happened in 1915. So to sum up 1915, for the most part, other than Italy coming in on the side of the Allies, 1915 is a bad year for the Allies. And of course, by the Allies, I mean Russia, Britain, and France. All their offensives on the Western Front get defeated and turned back. They don't really accomplish anything. We saw that on the Russian front, the Allies lose 300 miles of territory. We saw how in the last episode, how the Gallipoli offensive was shut down, the Salonika offensive was shut down, and the Serbs are conquered and Belgrade falls to the Central Powers. So something's got to change, Scott. It's looking like the Germans are just going to roll over. They're going to hold off everything that the Allies do in the West, and then they're just going to roll over Russia. We'll see if that happens.
Yeah, it seems like they'll just knock them out of the war, and due to their creeping technological superiority, whether with poisonous gas, air superiority, later on we'll see tank warfare, looking good for them. But we're going to see things change when we go back to the Western Front. We're going to be taking a look at the Battle of Verdun. See you there. All right, listeners, well, that is all that I have for today's episode. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our fantastic Spymasters include Chris C., David Santee, Josh from VFW Post 2285, Jake Harrington, Jennifer French Lee, Josh Reddick, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial in Las Vegas, Michael from New York, Michael Piccinetti, Nick Brooks, Rob from Chicago, Ryan Gillen, Salvador Sanchez, Tom from Ohio, Moondoggy from Ohio, Bill Ivey, and Bruce Ashby from Wire Meets Wood Guitars at WMWGuitars.com. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes, where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on Earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.